The Bookmark on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome to the program Michael Henson. He joins us on the telephone in Cincinnati. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Michael, you've got a new collection of stories out called Maggie Boylan. How'd you get the idea for this?
Well, I was working as a community organizer in a place called, a neighborhood called Lower Price Hill. In Cincinnati, it's an Appalachian migrant neighborhood. Most of the people there are from, they have their roots in East Kentucky or West Virginia or Tennessee. It was highly polluted. So I was hired to do some, community work around, the industries that were polluting the community. But it happened to also be at the time that, OxyContin made a jump from, the mountains were first from the Appalachian region, where it first hit hard into the urban centers, and so I just began to see a lot of tragic things going on, and we started working around it in the neighborhood. And I've always been a writer, so. These stories began to come into my head and began to show up on paper. So that's kind of where it starts.
Is that a rooster I'm hearing in the background?
That is. It's a rooster.
Uh-huh.
We have 18 chickens, two roosters.
Got to have at least two roosters with 18 chickens, huh?
Yeah, you're liable to hear my coonhound in a little bit.
All righty. Well,
he's known to start barking at the moles.
And adds to the ambiance. So you must be in a more rural part of Cincinnati.
Yeah, well, we're in the easternmost neighborhood. We have 500 acres of woods behind us.
I see.
We're like an urban version of a mullet. Mullet is they talk about it as business up front and party behind. We're city up front and country behind.
A mullet. I like that, Michael. Michael, Maggie Boylan is the character who ties all these stories together. This is a collection of stories, but it reads very much like a novella because we're moving through time with these stories. Tell us about Maggie. Who is she?
Well, she is a kind of a feisty woman. Has got a couple of kids that have been taken away from her because of her addiction, and she's got a husband in jail because he took the heat for her on a case, and she's dealing with a lot of issues, and one of them is her addiction to OxyContin. So.
Yeah. As we start to meet her in these stories, I think initially, I'm probably like a lot of readers, we're sort of repelled by her, and then we start to get to know her a little bit better, and we become much more sympathetic to her.
I wanted readers to see the addict as human, as a person with qualities that you could relate to.
Mm-hmm. And these are set in Ohio.
Yeah.
And I'm guessing that
it wouldn't have to be Ohio, but I made it Ohio.
I'm guessing that she's a composite of a lot of people that you've known, and so is the community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People have asked me, is she modeled on somebody in particular? And I've always denied that because the funding eventually ran out for the community organizing job, and I went back to my other career, which is drug and alcohol counseling. So I've started to see a lot of folks who struggled with that addiction, and I knew people in rural Appalachia. I have a lot of contacts in East Kentucky and Southeast Ohio. I've just seen a lot,
mm.
Both in my job and through friends and things that I read about in the paper.
Michael Henson joins us. His story collection is called Maggie Boylan, and it's recently been published by the Swallow Press of Ohio University Press in Athens. Let's talk a moment about this, what they're calling a crisis. When did you first become aware of this happening, and how has it been progressing in your view?
Well, I first became aware of it when I was working in Lower Price Hill. We were trying to focus around these environmental issues, and people were getting distracted away from that, and they were so concerned, overwhelmed by what was happening to their families. We actually had somebody's grandmother overdose on the steps of a social service agency in the neighborhood. So it was right there in front of me. I was helping people get hooked up with treatment, and then it began to get national awareness. There were articles in the New York Times. There were, you know, people were talking about it. There were videos had been made about it. It started to draw a lot of attention, and so I've made a over the years, I've made a study of this. And alcoholism has been around for centuries, you know, and it's embedded into the culture. But this was entirely created by corporate greed, and it was so obvious and so stunning how people could let this happen, mm-hmm. knowing that people were suffering. You know, how people could make at all sorts of levels. I mean, we think of a drug dealer as this guy in a hoodie standing on a corner, and here were these drug dealers that were in doctor's offices and pharmacies and corporate offices. So it was just an amazing social phenomenon that. But it was also happening to, I was seeing it on a very personal level with friends and people that I was working with. There's never been any serious attempt to hold the corporations responsible for this accountable. They paid some fines, but, you know, the job I took after I left the Urban Appalachian Council was working in halfway houses for guys coming out of prison, and so many people were in prison directly because of their relatively minor involvement with opiate addiction, whereas the guys that were truly responsible sitting pretty.
Still living in their mansion somewhere.
Yeah, and getting good, nice names. I if you go to the, I have a daughter who lives in New York City, and she and I went to the Sackler wing of the Metropolitan Museum of Art just to see, you know, what this money could do. It was haunting. I could almost feel the souls of the people that have been lost to this epidemic. They're in this very beautiful place, very, you know, quiet, meditative place.
Some of our listeners might not be familiar with the connection between the person that wing is named after.
Well, there's the Sackler family. There were three Sackler brothers who were all medical doctors, but also advertisers and pharmaceutical company owners. And they have made billions off this addiction. They're the major owners of Purdue Pharma, the company that that initiated OxyContin.
Is that the company that reputedly poured all that OxyContin into a little tiny town in West Virginia? Is that the same company?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. A rather notorious.
They had an army of salespeople. When reports came back that people were becoming addicted, they denied it. And it's all very well documented in Sam Quinones' Dreamland, which focuses on how it's morphed from one thing to another. So now we've done a lot of work to close down the pill mills, but we haven't expanded treatment sufficiently. So OxyContin addiction has morphed into a heroin addiction.
Heroin and fentanyl.
Yeah.
Because they can't get the oxy supply has been cut off. The other opioids have become harder to obtain. Have we hit bottom yet, in your view?
I have no way of knowing. We seem to be willing to build jails, but we don't seem to be willing to build treatment centers. So I'm working today to try to help get a kid into treatment. And that's the big stumbling block is where is he going to go?
The impediment is there's just no space.
Right. Right. The systems are all overwhelmed.
Yeah. Michael Henson joins me. His story collection is Maggie Boylan. You have some other characters in these stories, and a couple of them are police officers. And I'm sure that you've been able to look through their eyes at the problem. And I like these characters a lot.
There are some ways in which law enforcement has been part of the problem and some ways that law enforcement is been part of the solution. We're the community group that I work with now is working with one law officer in particular who he says he started with a lock 'em up attitude, and now he says we can't arrest our way out of this problem. We have to go with treatment. So you can see a lot of ways in which law enforcement is partnering with community groups to try to solve this problem. But there's, I've talked to people, and there's some evidence of corruption there, too. It's like everything else. It's a mix.
Yeah.
And some of the people that you count on to protect and serve the populace are actually profiting off this. I talked to an old colleague of mine who works in addiction still, and he says this opiate addiction business is a gold mine. He says one of the big problems we had in Lower Price Hill was that people were going to crossing the border to Indiana to a place called the East Indiana Treatment Center and picking up cheap methadone. Methadone is a great aid, a great asset in treating addiction. But if you don't apply it correctly, then you're just aiding the addiction. And so these people were getting supplies of methadone that were way over what they needed to control their cravings, and they were getting high. We had overdose. That overdose I described that happened on the steps of the social service center. That was a methadone overdose. They weren't providing counseling. They weren't providing therapy. They were just selling methadone.
And that's why they were all headed over in Indiana.
Yeah.
You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. My guest is Michael Henson. His book is Maggie Boylan. And in your book, Maggie lives just around the corner from a location they call Pillhead Hill. And I imagine there are variants of Pillhead Hill scattered all across the Appalachian region. Tell us about Pillhead Hill. What is it?
Well, Pillhead Hill is a creation of mine. I just imagined it as a place where people gather illicit opiates and other drugs and sell them out of there, so people know they can go to, if they want to get high, they can go to Pillhead Hill and get their stuff. So, and just so happens Maggie lives across from Pillhead Hill, and it also becomes the site of a I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah, a very dramatic final chapter, a very dramatic final story in the book.
There were things that I wanted to say in the book about all the things I've been talking about with the corruption of the medical industry and so on, but that just wouldn't they just wouldn't fit as part of the story. So Maggie and the other characters just wanted to tell their story the way they wanted to tell their story. I wanted to create a work of art, not a polemic.
Yeah. Well, we also get the impression, just kind of off in the periphery here, that the judiciary is also involved in the problem, or could be.
Could be. I've read about instances of corrupt law enforcement. I've read about instances of corrupt judges and so on. So I just wanted to tell a story, and I hope nobody's thinking I made a generalization.
It's a work of fiction, yes.
Pardon?
It's a work of fiction.
It's a work of fiction.
Yes.
And so I'm trying to tell a story that could happen and has happened.
Well, Michael, you've told us somewhat about your day jobs, the things you've done over the years aside from writing, and I made a point of not Googling you because I wanted you to tell me about your writing career. I see here you've written a lot of stuff. Do you want to tell us about your writing career, how you got started, and what kind of stuff you've been writing?
I started writing straight out of college. I went to Xavier University. I came from not too far from where you are. I came from Sydney, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
So I got involved in writing while in college, but I decided to get serious about it after college. So I've got a novel called Ransack, which is also deals a lot with addiction in an inner city context. Most of my writing has been inner city, but I've written a lot about rural Appalachia. I lived for a while in rural Appalachia. So I've got fourth book of fiction. I've got four books of poetry. And I also wrote a novella called Tommy Perdue, which dealt with OxyContin before Maggie.
Mm.
So I just try to keep different projects going, try to tell stories that I think don't get told otherwise.
Well, you have some great titles. I'm guessing that A Small Room with Trouble on My Mind is a book of poetry?
No, that's actually a novella with stories. The title novella, A Small Room with Trouble on My Mind, is a novella. It tells a story of a bluegrass musician and his family.
Mm.
So that's a line from a bluegrass song. I'd rather be in some dark holler where the sun don't ever shine than to be in some big city in a small room with trouble on my mind.
Mm.
So that's my other vice is bluegrass music.
Uh-huh.
I play in a little band we call Carter Bridge.
Carter Bridge?
Yep.
You like the Carters?
Oh, yeah. Gosh.
Yeah.
Gosh, well, the Carter family is just...
What's your instrument?
Well, I play guitar and a little bit of mandolin.
Mm-hmm.
I play mandolin poorly.
I see you've got another title called The Tao of Longing and the Body Geographic. Now, that's got to be poetry.
That's poetry.
Okay.
Those are actually love songs.
Okay.
Most of the time I'm writing dour things about. Somebody asked me one time, don't you ever write any happy poems? Well, no, not exactly, but these are actually love poems. I had written mostly fiction for years and years, and maybe would write a poem every now and then. But a friend of mine named Buddy Gray, who was a housing activist in Cincinnati in the Over the Rhine neighborhood where I used to live, was murdered, and that experience affected me profoundly. And the only way I could even talk about it was through poetry. I physically couldn't even speak when I'd try to talk about it. But I could write these poems. So I ended up writing a book of poems called Crow Call, which is a way of dealing with. They're all somehow related to Buddy and the issues that he stood for.
Poetry was your way of dealing with that loss.
Yeah. So for a while there, I said, "Well, I had had some frustration trying to get some fiction projects published, and I said I'm never going to write fiction again." So I wrote poetry pretty solidly for a while, had The Dow of Longing, and then another book of poetry called The True Story of the Resurrection, which is a book of poems on biblical themes. I take either lines from the Bible or stories from the Bible and try to reinterpret them. Then recently I had a book of called The Dead Singing, which is just a collection of verse on various topics. So now I'm more in a fiction phase. I'm having trouble getting any poetry going. I've written a few songs, but that process seems to have dried up. That's funny how this works. I just go through phases where one takes over.
You never know, do you?
Yeah.
You can't control it.
Yeah.
Well, I love your prose. I think Maggie Boylan is beautifully written and
thank you.
Very powerful, and I was very impressed by it. I'm going to have to dig up some more of your stuff. Is it easy to get published?
Oh, it's agonizing. That's what attracted me about poetry for a while was that I could write a poem and I could go to a reading, speak it, and it was out there. But the stories are much harder to get out in the world. So I've got a shelf of things. I retired a couple years back, and so I've got time to finish up some of these projects that I've had kind of piecemeal. So I still have two novels that are unpublished. One of them has been rejected 50-some-odd times, and I've got two books of essays that I'm trying to peddle and another book of stories. It's there's a lot of people trying to get attention.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of good writing out there. There's a lot of good, not that the good writing always gets published. I've got friends that are really fine writers that don't get near the attention that I see other people getting. But I guess that's just the way it goes.
Can you give us some names? Who are these writers that we should be looking for?
Richard Haig is another Ohio writer that he and I were college roommates, and I think he's the best poet working in the country today.
Richard Haig?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. H-A-G-U-E.
Uh-huh.
He's done some amazing things. Pauletta Hansel is another good writer that's that I don't think gets the attention she deserves. There's a fellow named Jim Webb down in Whitesburg, Kentucky, whose work I admire a lot. We have a little group we call the Southern Appalachian Writers Cooperative. We meet once or twice a year to share our work and to support each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's a guy, Robert Guype, who also is getting published. He seems to have gotten the attention of a lot of folks. He's also been published by the Swallow Press of Ohio University Press. You can be well-known within a certain circle and utterly unknown outside of it. I think some people can be well known in the Appalachian circle, and nobody else knows. You know, like I don't know if you're familiar with James Still.
No.
He's probably the best known among the classic Appalachian authors, and he's revered among Appalachian writers. But I don't think anybody knows outside that circle. I don't think anybody really knows about him, and he should be. He should be in all the anthologies. He's a wonderful writer.
First time I've heard the name, James Still.
Still.
Mm-hmm.
S-T-I-L-L. He doesn't have a real big shelf. He has a wonderful novel called The River of Earth.
Mm.
A few collections of stories and some poetry. But he lived in Hindman, Kentucky most of his life, and wrote about that region in a very compelling way that I think is could be a model for many writers, but nobody really knows of him outside of Appalachian literature.
Well, Michael, I know you've got to run to your next engagement. I just have one more question. This novel that is unpublished that's been rejected 50 times, what's it about?
Well, it involves three characters who meet in the uptown neighborhood of Chicago, which was back in the 70s, it was a hub of Appalachian migration.
Mm.
And so they all come from various places in Appalachia to meet there. So it tells the story of each of their journeys to that place.
Mm.
Suggests what could come of that meeting, how they come together. Kind of on the model of Ulysses by James Joyce, where you have these three kind of concurrent stories running together.
Okay.
I'm real happy with it, but I haven't been able to convince anybody else, so I guess that's the way it goes.
Yeah. Well, Michael, it's really been a pleasure to have you on the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for calling.
My guest has been
talking to you, and wish you luck.
My guest has been Michael Henson. His new story collection, Maggie Boylan, just out on the Swallow Press of Ohio University in Athens. You've been listening to Book Nook on WYSO. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes.